week since the events of 7th of October, where various groups from the Gaza Strip carried out an audacious operation in southern Israel. Hamas and various other groups captured army bases, hostages and soldiers, and even carried out an amphibious assault. Israel is still shocked a week on, and they've called it their 9/11, and they're gearing up for a ground invasion of Gaza Strip. This will have major implications, and here to unpack it all is the Geopolity founder, Adnan Khan. Now, Adnan, we're sitting here after 1 week since the initial attack. Can you explain what we know now, what actually happened, and where we currently stand?
Okay, Yusuf. I think just to give a caveat on the get-go, it's Friday 13th today, so we are, what, a week since the event. And actually, there's a lot we still don't know. There's a lot of details we don't know. So it's possible once this podcast goes out and in the days and weeks ahead, some of the facts do change and things that we don't know, we become aware of. So what I'm going to really try and do in this podcast is try and stick to what we definitely know. Things which are 50-50 or unknown, I'll try and point that out. So Saturday morning last week, what we do know is around 10, 11 Palestinian groups based in Gaza, they carried out a large-scale invasion into the southern part of occupied Israel. And what we do know is they launched this operation or assault with a huge barrage of rockets that went into southern Israel. And under the cover of this rocket attack, they infiltrated into the south of Israel around Gaza. So we do know they made it about 15 miles into southern Israel. They made use of various forms of transport and tactics that we've not seen before. So they used trucks, pickup trucks, motorcycles, bulldozers, speedboats, and even paragliders. So the assault achieved a surprise that Israel is not accustomed to. And we have to keep in mind, Yusuf, that the Gaza-based groups, they generally fire rockets into southern Israel. They've never really been able to carry out attacks into the south of Israel because Gaza effectively is sealed off from the rest of the country. We saw them get into a number of Israeli towns. They took a number of hostages. They took a number of soldiers as hostages as well. And for the first time, shockingly, they even overran a number of military outposts where they seized weapons and equipment. And they even established logistical lines from within Israeli territory. We also know that teams of fighters on hand gliders were able to get over the defensive barrier that we have in Gaza. They also did an amphibious assault. They got into the Zikam military base and I think they held it for a number of hours. So the Palestinian groups, they utilized the element of surprise. They were able to create a number of temporary advantages in terms of numbers and firepower. Now, we don't know yet, but naturally there must have been some level of planning carry out this level of attack, and to be this successful requires that. We see they employed various tactics that we haven't actually seen before. And what we're finding, Yusuf, is the Israelis are really still in shock. They can't believe, minus the deaths and the hostages, but the audaciousness of this operation, the broad scope of it, and how they were able to achieve advantages in a very short period. We've never experienced this before. I would even go as far as saying, Yusuf, this is the first time since 1948 Palestinians actually seized territory. Because Palestinians really have been losing territory since the creation of Israel. So this is where we really are now. We're really still in the beginning part of this assault or uprising or this new development. And I'm sure in the days and weeks ahead, there's going to be further developments.
It is a very crazy point when you put it like that, that this is the first time in 70 years that Palestinians have actually managed to take some land. What's the official position of both the Israeli government and Hamas at the moment?
Okay, so there were really, you said, about 10, 11 groups involved. So although everyone is calling this a Hamas operation, it isn't. It's actually much more broader than that. For some reason, the media are calling it a Hamas attack, and no one's saying otherwise, but really there was actually 10, 11 different groups. One of them was Hamas, and again, we don't really know the details of who was exactly leading it. But the operation was called Al-Aqsa Flood, and on the day of the assault, the leadership of groups that did the attack, they made a statement, and they actually recorded a statement as well where they said the desecration of Al-Aqsa was why they did this. And what they've been doing is, obviously, as far as they're concerned, they're resisting an occupation. something they've been doing for decades. And this is just the latest move in that resistance. So the Israeli position is they are still in shock. The successive governments, you know, security has always been the number one issue for Israelis. And obviously, since the 1973 war, they've never really had to deal with this sort of operation. So they're in shock. There's a lot of talk. Where was the intelligence, this world-class intelligence that Israel's always had? How did they miss this? Some former Israeli intelligence officers and senior military personnel actually questioning that something sinister must have been at play, because in their mind, the level of technology surveillance Israel does the Gaza Strip, this wasn't actually possible. The official position of the government is this has been a shocking event. It's led to the death of innocent civilians. And what we're seeing now is the Israeli government has to respond. And I'm sure we're going to discuss this. They're now gearing up for an invasion of the Gaza Strip. Already, the territory is under siege. It's been sealed. Well, it was sealed off even before this, but that's been the official position. So what you're finding, Yusuf, is a lot of 9/11 discourse creeping in. This was Israel's 9/11. You know, you're seeing a lot of figures flying out of percentage-wise how many people passed away, how many 9/11s will be. Netanyahu has been completely undermined. He was the security man. There's calls for him to resign. In fact, today I will be reading this morning, 60% of Israelis believe he needs to go after this war is over. So the Israeli official position is we've been attacked by these terrorists and their response is going to be a ground invasion and Israel is facing its 9/11.
So on this point about intelligence, there has been a lot of discussion about this. Is your opinion that Israel didn't know it was happening and they had no intelligence of it?
So this is probably one of those questions, Yusuf. In time, we will find out. Similar to every time we've done podcasts on Ukraine, we've always said, why did Russia's invasion go so bad at the beginning? And we're not really going to know until probably many years down the line when people who are involved in decision-making tell us what happened and why it went wrong. What you've got here is there are some things that don't add up, which is the level of surveillance, the level of monitoring, intelligence, even spies they have in Gaza. How was something of this scale possible? And I don't actually have an answer for that. What I actually have is more questions. On the flip side, Yusuf, I think we do need to take something into account, which is that firstly, the Israeli military is mostly stationed in the West Bank. But in the West Bank, you've got a large Palestinian population and you've got loads of settlements, so they need to be protected. So Gaza, if you look, they've completely sealed off. They control the entry and the exit. They control the airspace, the electricity, the trade. So you don't really need many troops there because you're using technology and surveillance to monitor that area. Where Israel's military mostly is situated is in the West Bank, because that's a different scenario. It's in the mountains. It's a much larger territory. You need physical troops to protect the settlements. So the physical presence of Israeli military is not very large in the south of Israel. Secondly, whatever intelligence you receive of movement of rockets is still a person who has to analyze and interpret it. So Yusuf, we're a week in. 8 days ago, the Middle East was very peaceful. Saudi Arabia was normalizing relations with Israel. Bahrain, UAE, Sudan, Morocco had already normalized it. Netanyahu was probably in his strongest position he's been in. The Israeli military were on a religious holiday. What was there to worry about? The Palestinian resistance, the struggle, was probably at its weakest point. If you take that into account, would you really have expected there to be an attack? Where would you put your resources? Would you really put them around Gaza? So I think these two things, where there's a lot of stuff that doesn't add up, and if you look at the context we were in 8 days ago, when you balance them out, I'm not sure which side things fall on. So there are some unanswered questions that we have. But if we look at the context we were in, why would you have your eyes on the Gaza Strip 8 days ago? You wouldn't, because what's going on there? Well, nothing really. You've got it under lockdown. 7 days on, you know, how quickly things can change. So again, I think it's one of the things we're going to have to wait until we get more info. But the points I made is what I think we need to take into account.
Okay, now Hamas, I know you mentioned that it was multiple groups and not just Hamas, but yeah, Hamas is on the spotlight. They're being called terrorists, they're a proscribed organization, and they are really losing the information war. Can you tell me a little bit more about their origin and what are they all about?
So Hamas actually, Yusuf, in origin is a political movement. It's not actually a militant or an armed group. So Hamas emerged in 1987. It was established by a Muslim Brotherhood cleric called Sheikh Yassin. And what was going on is by the 80s, people had lost hope in the PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, who were considered the official representatives of the Palestinians. They were secular, they were corrupt, and people saw them as having compromised and sold out the Palestinian cause. So in this era of frustration, a new group emerged, and the Muslim Brotherhood, wherever they go, they set up welfare movement, they set up hospitals, education establishments. So that's how it actually began. But what Hamas realized was, how are we going to deal with the occupation? Because for the Palestinians to live in peace, you're living under occupation. And their conclusion was, is the occupation of Palestine was violent by the Zionists. So the only way to deal with this, the only way to reverse the occupation, is by using violent means. So in origin, their aims are actually political. They want to be seen as a political party who wants a political resolution. And their methods were violent because they are under occupation. So what's really happened as the years have gone on, Yusuf, is all people see is the armed resistance that they do. All people look at is the rocket attacks that they do. However, Hamas and the Israeli government have carried out loads of diplomatic talks. They've even done prisoner exchanges. And what's really happened over the years, Yusuf, is because Hamas want to be seen as a rational actor, as a political actor, they've actually compromised a lot with their original positions in order to get this credibility. However, the Israelis and much of the world still label them as a terrorist group. For Hamas, for example, Yusuf, they actually accept the two-state solution. Their argument is we should go back to 1967 borders, which is the Gaza Strip and the West Bank should be Palestinian state, and the rest of it Israel can have. So really, Yusuf, they actually support the two-state solution more than Israel even does. But in their need to be seen as a political player, they've compromised a lot. And this is why they've lost a lot of credibility over the years. And really, much of the world just see them as a terrorist group that carries out terrorist actions. The way Hamas and the Palestinians see it, they are under occupation and they are fighting resistance against the occupiers. Obviously, much of the world calls that terrorism, but that's how the Palestinians see it. And that's how Hamas see it as well. The Zionist or the Israeli position is they experienced brutal anti-Semitism in Europe in the 1800s, in the early 1900s. And then they experienced the Holocaust in Europe. Therefore, they needed their own homeland. They tried a lot to integrate into Europe, but they weren't accepted due to the anti-Semitism. So they needed a homeland and they needed a safe haven for the Jews. That's what became Israel. And it's the Muslims surrounding them. It's the Palestinians who are not accepting this. And that's why we have this struggle going on today. So that's the official position. But we've got to keep in mind that there were Jews in Palestine before Israel was created. In fact, even before World War I, these were Arab Jews. What we have in terms of Israel is European Jews who wanted nationhood. So what we really have is you have settlers who came and colonized Palestine. They kicked out, using violence, the indigenous people. And now they call it their homeland. So this is the bit they don't really talk about. What they talk about is we were victims, we need a homeland. So with the help of Britain and much of Europe, they were given a homeland in somebody else's land. So that's no different to settler colonialism, and they're still trying to colonize the territory. So that's what the settlements and all of these sort of things are about. So because they're a people, because they originate from Europe, these European Jews, that's why their struggle and their narrative is largely adopted by the West. And that's why what you see is everybody knows about the Zionist struggle. Everybody knows that they're trying to achieve statehood. Very few people know about the Palestinian plight. And not that many people know further about the details of settler colonialism that they're trying to carry out. So, you know, in settler colonialism, your agenda is you want to take the land of somebody else and you want to settle there. So the challenge you have is, what do you do with the original people that are there? And in most cases, what you do is you violently uproot them. And that is where we are. We're still in that process where they're trying to violently uproot the people that were there, the indigenous people.
On Question Time last night in the UK, no one had an answer on how to solve this intractable problem. How can anyone move forward from what's been happening and what happened last week?
So that's a good question, Yusuf. There's really two ways these sort of things get solved. So obviously, what's going on at the moment is you had this assault by Hamas. And really, the framework, the way everyone's looking at this, is Hamas carried out something that was unforgivable, and do you condemn it or not? So we have to like completely not look at 75 years of history, but to understand, you know, what happened last week didn't happen in a vacuum. There's been a lot of stuff going on. And what you've got here is really there's two ways you solve this problem. Like, historically, there's only been two ways. So the first is the occupier leaves. So the occupier either packs up or they're defeated. So if you remember the British Empire in India, they realized in the end that it was too costly to be in India. They had colonized the territory and they got up and left after World War II. The other examples were the French, they were defeated in Algeria. So that's one way this gets solved, where the occupier, which in this case is Zionists, they call it a day or they are physically defeated. The other way this gets resolved is the occupier, they carry out a genocide and seize the land. And that resolves it because you massacred the people. So this is how the United States is there today. They carried out a genocide against the indigenous Red Indians. And that's why you find the white settlers came to dominate the North American continent. You find similarly, this is how white settlers today dominate Australia, because they carried out a genocide against the Aborigines. And we find similar Dutch and English settlers, they came to dominate South Africa, but they carried out a genocide against the black population. So Palestine is a problem of settler colonialism and the slow motion expulsion of the people. So either they succeed and that solves the problem, or they fail and the inhabitants of a land, they succeed. They are really the only two ways. And just to explain yourself, you know, normal classical colonialism is where a power goes to a place and therefore the resources. So they establish whatever government is needed to do that. Settler colonialism is where foreign people go and physically settle there. So that's what the French tried to do in Algeria. You go there, you oppress the indigenous people, you set up an apartheid nation, and then you take over their land. So we know in South Africa from 1948 to 1992, that's what the white settlers did. They established an apartheid state. So what's interesting, Yusuf, is up until 8 days ago, normalization of Israel was going perfectly. But these normalization talks with Saudi, Bahrain, UAE, Morocco, Sudan, none of it involved the Palestinian people. The Palestinian people were not even at the table. It didn't even involve talking about a Palestinian state. All it was about a number of Arab countries, they recognized Israel's right to exist. So if you look at it, that gives you some background into the context of why this attack even happened. Because the Palestinians struggled within the verge of being wiped out. There was no discussion about the Palestinian people. They weren't even at the table for these discussions. So really, Yusuf, they're the only two ways these sort of things get solved. And if you look at history, these are the only two ways the issues get solved.
Adnan, I know you're saying there's only two ways that this can actually get solved, but the two-state solution has been, it's been something that, it's the only solution that's been proposed since as far back as I can remember. If you said earlier that Hamas has accepted that two-state solution, why can't that be a viable outcome?
So this is a very interesting question, Yusuf. The narrative is, the problem with a two-state solution is the Palestinians refuse to accept the Zionists being in Palestine. So they put the problem at the doorstep of the Palestinians. And then usually what you find is, you know, they're anti-Semitic and that's why. But the leadership, whether you like them or not, of the Palestinians, in whatever guise, accepted two-state solution a long time ago. So the Palestinian Authority, the PLO, Fatah, they accepted two-state solution a long time ago. Hamas has fallen over itself to accept the two-state solution. Their argument here is, so Gaza and the West Bank should be the Palestinian state. The obstacle to two-state solution, which doesn't get media coverage, is actually Israel itself. It's the Israeli leadership, it's the Zionist leadership. And there's a number of reasons for this. Firstly, Yusuf, when Israel was established, the Israeli leadership, they never saw Israel in permanent borders. They saw Israel is going to be growing as a country. That's why any talk of Israeli borders, they avoid. Because they want Israel to grow. Because Israel, you know, in a way, it's a foreign entity. It's a settler colonial project. Therefore, you don't want to define your borders. But if you define your borders, you're surrounded by countries which are much bigger than you and a threat to you. So that was the first challenge. The second challenge is, Yusuf, is if we look at the geography of Palestine, historic Palestine is the sliver of land that runs from Lebanon down to the Sinai in Egypt. So if you look at it width-wise, a fighter jet could fly across the West Bank and Israel in a couple of minutes. That's how small it is. So the West Bank, Yusuf, is higher land. The majority of Israel's population lives from Haifa in the north of Israel, running down along the coast to the south of Israel. So this small territory is only 10 miles wide, and it's looking up at the mountains and the hills, which is the West Bank. So if the West Bank becomes the Palestinian state and the Gaza Strip does, Israel has a huge security nightmare. The high land is with the Palestinians. The Palestinians are an independent state. They will have their own military. Israel doesn't have the capability or the economy to deal with the security situation. So that's why they cannot accept the two-state solution. The two-state solution means you have an independent Palestinian state, independent military, independent military capability, and Israel has a territory which geographically can't survive. And that's why you find the two-state solution didn't come from the Zionists. It didn't come from the Palestinians. It didn't come from the Arab leaders. It was the American plan. Originally, it was Britain who facilitated the migration of the Zionists to Palestine. And Britain was unsure if it would be accepted. So the Britain outsourced this problem to the UN. It was the UN then who said we would partition Palestine. However, in the 1967 war, Israel took over the Sinai. It took over the West Bank, took over the Golan Heights. And that's where America proposed the two-state solution. So the reason why you can't have two states has nothing to do with the Palestinian people. It has nothing to do with the West Bank or the Gaza Strip. In fact, their land keeps getting taken off them. The major obstacle standing in the way of two states is actually Israel themselves. For strategic, economic, and tactical reasons, they can't have two states. So the only way you're going to get two states is when and if America imposes it. America will say, this is the Palestinian state, here's the borders. Given the opportunity, Israel will keep expanding its territory, which it has been doing. So that's why the two-state solution can't work. I know the narrative is the Palestinians are the problem, but the Palestinian resistance groups and most of their leadership, they accepted two states a long time ago. The actual issue is the Israelis, and as I mentioned, for strategic purposes.
How much is religion at the heart of this issue?
So what comes across when you watch the Palestinian issue is religion is central to this. So you've got the Jews who believe this is their homeland. You've got the Jews who believe Revelation says this land belongs to them. You've got the Muslims who believe this is their land. You've got the Muslims who conquered this territory. So there's all these religious justification. But you see, when we take a step back and we look at how the issues evolved, what you find, there's actually very little religion has to do with the issue. However, religion being muddied with the issue. The reason why the Jews from Europe ended up in Palestine is because they were being persecuted in Europe. Anti-Semitism was rife in the 1800s. So because they were being oppressed, they needed somewhere else to go. So they decided we're going to go to Palestine. So there's nothing religious about that. They were being persecuted. Any people that were being persecuted, you would leave that area. As far as the Palestinians are concerned, if aliens landed on Earth and they took over this area, it's an occupation, we're going to fight them back. If it were Hindus who took over this area, if it was people from Australia that took this place over, it's the same outcome, which is, this is our land, we lived here, you are now seizing the territory, and you're kicking us out. So they're resisting. So from that perspective, religion actually had nothing to do with it. Because when Palestinians are accused of having religious hatred, the assumption there is if you didn't have Islam, you would accept the occupation. And that's laughable. No people will accept an occupation because of the belief of other people. So from there, you can see, so what's happened is religion really is muddied the issue. Really, religion has very little to do with it. Because if it wasn't Jews, it was somebody else, the Palestinian response would still be the same. This land has been occupied, it's been stolen from us, we need to resist it.
I know you make that point that it's a political issue and not a religious issue, but with the dispute mainly being between Zionist Jews and Palestinian Muslims, globally it's actually become more of a religious issue. So you see religious allegiances. How would you address that?
So the way we're going to look at this, Yusuf, is Zionism is not Judaism. In fact, most Zionists are not Jews, and many Jews don't even support the Israeli state. In fact, today, more Jews live outside Israel than they do in Israel. And when Israel first was created, the biggest problem they had, in fact, from 1917, when Jews started to move to Palestine, their biggest problem was nobody wanted to move. The European Jews who were being persecuted, they wanted to become accepted in Europe. So you find that we have to make a distinction between Zionism and Judaism. They're not the same thing. In many ways, what you could say, Yusuf, Judaism, as we know, is the historic belief. And within Judaism, you've got various schools of thought, various flavors. Zionists were those Jews who believed that they should have a homeland. So Zionism is nationalism. And it's interesting because Jews never believed in nationalism for most of their history. So there's a big distinction between the two. Obviously, it's in Israel's interest that they need to say, no, there's no distinction between the two. So that's why Israel says that they represent all Jews globally, even though most Jews don't actually have a link with Israel. So I remember when there was the attack in France a few years ago, where a couple of Jews were killed. There was all this outpouring of support, and Netanyahu went to Paris, and he actually said that the Jews in France need to come back. And the Jews in France started singing the French national anthem. Their point to Netanyahu was, we're French, we're not actually Israeli. So that's how they actually view it. From a Muslim perspective, yes, Palestine is blessed land, but Muslims, Jews and Christians live side by side in Palestine for the last millennia. From around 630, when the Muslims acquired or conquered Palestine, up until 1970 when the British took it over, so that's over a millennia, minus the Crusades during the 1100s, all of that period, Jews, Muslims, Christians live side by side. Okay, the population was small and the Arab Jewish population was very small. The Muslims have a long history of living side by side with people of other faiths. So as far as Muslims are concerned, Yusuf, this is land that was seized from them, where Muslims resided for over a millennium. And that's what they're fighting. In this case, it happens to be Jews or Zionists from Europe who are settler colonists. So if it was anyone, the outcome would have been the same. So the involvement of religion in this issue is actually very small, but it's in the interests of all people to bring more religion in order to justify their positions.
Iran has recently come out saying that although they support the Palestinian cause, they had no involvement in the attacks on 7th of October. How much of that is true?
So for once, Yusuf, it seems all the players are unified on the lack of Iran's role in this assault. So the Israelis are saying that they've not seen any intelligence to suggest Iran was involved. The American Jack Sullivan said they've seen no intelligence. And the Iranians are also saying that they weren't involved. So this is probably the only thing about the issue everyone's unified on. Now, Iran usually has backed Hezbollah. They trained and armed them and set them up and established them. And they play a role in Lebanon. In terms of the other groups, the resistance groups, what you find is Iran has provided arms to some of them in the past. So that these rockets that the Gaza-based groups used. There's been some training, but the actual day-to-day operation, they're not really involved because Hezbollah is the capable force who they've invested in. Hamas originated from the Muslim Brotherhood, and it's a Sunni-based organization largely. In the West Bank, you find the groups that are there, their support comes from places like Turkey and other Muslims. So really, Iran's involvement is probably, what I read, Yusuf, is Iran gave the green light. That was the official Israeli position. How on earth do you prove Iran gave a green light? I'm not sure. But secondly, if Iran is supporting a group to do resistance and that group does resistance, you know, does that mean they gave the go ahead? I mean, that's the whole idea of your support, that you support them in order to resist. So I think what's going on here is if Iran's involved, then that potentially makes this a regional wide problem. If Iran's not involved, then this is a domestic Palestinian-Israeli issue. So again, the role of Iran comes down to politics now. What side of the fence you're on and what your long-term agenda is.
What's been the international response and the response of the Arab rulers and the Muslim rulers?
Okay, so the international response really is twofold. So the Western response is very clear. They stand shoulder to shoulder with Israel. So the Americans, the French, the British and the Western generally, this was a callous terrorist attack and Israel had the right to defend itself even when it's laying siege on all of Gaza. And they're very clear, we're standing shoulder to shoulder with it. The Arab rule is very interesting, Yusuf. Some of them have condemned the Hamas attack and they are saying that there needs to be a long-term solution. No one has come out and supported the resistance openly. So Erdogan, who cut ties with Israel when the Turkish flotilla was attacked and Turkish citizens killed, he cut ties. There's no cutting off ties here. Saudi Arabia, until 8 days ago, was normalizing relations. So, you know, that's probably all going down the drain currently, or it's going to be frozen for a long period of time. The UAE was the only one that openly criticized Hamas. They said that this was bang out of order, and they called it terrorism. So I would question, Yusuf, is there really two poles when we look at this issue? You've got the West who are openly, clearly siding with Israel. And then you've got the Muslim and Arab rulers who are saying things but not doing anything. So if you're not doing anything, then really you're on the side of Israel. So that's really been the international response. I suspect some of this may change going forward, Yusuf, because Israel's gearing up for an invasion. It's going to be brutal. They've already sealed off the Gaza Strip. And what you're going to see is already there's been a lot of demonstrations throughout the Muslim world. And this is going to put a lot of the Muslim rulers in very difficult positions. So you might find the positions are going to change as we go forward. But in many ways, Yusuf, the international response was predictable. The West are going to side with Israel. That doesn't mean anything tangible at the moment. It's not like they need to arm or put soldiers on the ground. It's more from a political perspective. We're standing shoulder to shoulder with you, like they stood with the Ukrainians. And the Arab rulers, again, lots of talk, very little action. Even the OIC hasn't even met yet. The Arab League hasn't even met yet, despite, you know, what seems to be transpiring now with the invasion on Gaza.
The Taliban came out and said that they would like to actually support the Palestinian cause fighters. How likely is that?
I mean, fighters is not the challenge the Palestinians have. They've got plenty of people. Their large population, it's arms, it's equipment, it's heavy weaponry. So obviously the Taliban, who are Islamic, and Palestine is blessed land, and there's an occupation being fought there by Muslims. So they had to say something. Tangibly, what they can do, I think they're quite limited. They've got their own challenges in Afghanistan at the moment. They've just had two earthquakes in the last week. So again, you know, there's a whole information war taking place and people got to take positions on it. And obviously, the Taliban now are the official government of Afghanistan, so they have to address international issues. They have to give their position. They have to be anti or pro, and that's what they're doing. At the moment, they don't need to physically do anything more than that.
Okay, I've seen there's been a whole information war currently taking place online over the narrative, over social media, on the news. I have a few questions that I wanted to put to you and get your view on it and get your view on them. So number one, Israel has a biblical right over Palestine as their homeland.
This is a common argument you hear. I think we've got to put this into perspective. Firstly, most Jews actually don't believe that. The belief that the Jews have a homeland in Palestine is actually the view of evangelical Christians. They believe the end of times will come is when the Jews go back to where they were kicked out. So the Romans kicked out the Jews in early period. And since then, obviously, the Jews have been in different parts of the world. So there's always been this talk that we want to go back. Now, most Jews don't believe that. Most Jews have gone to other parts of the world. And what you find, this is the Zionist view. And as I mentioned to you, so most Zionists are not Jews. Most people that support a Jewish homeland are actually not even Jewish. So Israel having a biblical right, well, you know, anybody could bring a book and say, we have a right to that land. But what they mean by biblical right is that's where we originated from and that's our homeland. That's what they're actually arguing. So for some reason, that then gives them a right to go there and expel the indigenous people. That's the context of what that actually means. And Jews really, in large numbers, have not lived in Palestine for over a millennia. They were in other parts of the world. And in fact, the Jewish population, most of history, has been so small. The Jews that did live in Palestine, there were Jews in Palestine, but they were just very small in number. But even if they do have a biblical right and we accept it, does that give them the right to expel the indigenous people of Palestine? Because the argument here is, because we have a right there, the inhabitants have to go. And the question I'm putting is, even whatever right you've got, wherever it comes from, does it make it okay to kick out the indigenous people that have been there for over a millennia? And I think that's the context we've got to look at this claim.
International law recognizes the Jewish right to nationhood.
So that is correct. International law, the League of Nations, and then the United Nations after that, they created the partition plan to partition Palestine. So they took somebody else's land and decided to give it to another people. So yes, international law does recognize it, but that's the problem. International law was established by the powers of the day. And so the powers of the day did things that suited them and their agenda. So the League of Nations was established after World War I because we can't be going to war, global war, to solve international issues. So Britain and France established the League of Nations and they established it and they gave themselves mandates to run the Middle East. So amongst that mandate, they facilitated European Jews to come to Palestine. And then eventually they declared it their own homeland. So international law is a problem. You find for Muslims across the world, international law has been a massive problem. You look at Kashmir, you look at Palestine, you look at Bosnia. All of these problems were made worse by international law. So the fact that international law recognizes your right is meaningless because international law even oppresses many other people. We know what happened in Rwanda between the different tribes there as well. So this is a very weak argument that international law, tomorrow international law could give Palestine to Hindus. Would that make it okay? But remember, what is international law? It is the United Nations today voting on something. So laws are rules people make up. The difference here is international law is laws that go beyond borders. It applies to everybody. So from a Zionist perspective, I get this, because it strengthens their view that, look, international law recognizes our right. But international law is a problem. So Palestinians will say international law robbed us of our land. International law robbed us of our land and gave it to a foreign people.
Muslims don't accept Israel's right to exist due to anti-Semitism. I know you've touched on this briefly, but it is a big discussion point.
So I think there's two perspectives we've got to understand with this, is that anti-Semitism actually has its origins in Europe. And that's why the Holocaust took place in Europe and not in any other part of the world. I remember the Spanish Inquisition in the 1400s, that again was in Europe as well. Muslims and Jews, all of their history have lived side by side together. In fact, some Jews even argue if it wasn't for Islam, Judaism was on the verge of being wiped off the earth. And what they mean by that is the Roman Empire, the Byzantines, had kicked the Jews out from the Middle East. So the Jews were just all over the world and they couldn't even practice their faith. When Islam came along, Islam recognized there was a Jewish people who received revelation. They recognized Christianity. And therefore, wherever Muslims ruled, they recognized the rights of Jews. And that's why the Jews were able to flourish under Islamic rule in many, many different areas. So when the Inquisition happened in Spain, the Jews went to Turkey and their descendants are still there today. So Muslims have never had a problem with Jews throughout their history as a people. Anti-Semitism is a European problem. So because of the Holocaust, what they're doing is they're applying this label to Muslims, which completely goes against Muslim history. But what this means, Yusuf, is if these people weren't Jews, Muslims would have accepted their land being taken from them by another people. What they're arguing is purely because they're Jews and you hate Jews, that's why you are not accepting your land being taken off you. And, you know, if it wasn't so serious, that's laughable. And as I mentioned, Yusuf, if these occupiers were Hindus or aliens, the response of the indigenous people would be the same. So what this does, Yusuf, is, again, as you mentioned, is part of the information war, and is to muddy the waters.
Next question, Adnan. Israel defeated Arab armies and they legitimately won the land.
So that sounds to me as you went to war to occupy land, and you won, so now you're occupying the land. And in many ways, that is what they have done. Now, does that make it legitimate? Does it make it okay? Everybody would tell you just because you won the war doesn't make it morally legitimate, or it doesn't make it morally okay for you to occupy the land. Now, historically, if you defeated the people, you would overtake that land. But again, it's not you've defeated the people and we're going to live side by side, we're going to rule over you. What is going on in Palestine, Yusuf, is you have an apartheid system where Palestinians have a different legal system which oppresses them, and they have no rights, not even remotely the same as Israelis. So what this argument is everything we're doing now is perfectly legitimate because we won the war, right? And you know, no sane person will say it's okay to oppress the people because you won the war. This is the argument of colonialism. This was the argument when the Portuguese, the Spanish, the British, the French went to other countries and said, because we conquered you, we are superior, we are civilized, and we have to civilize you. This is the colonial argument that they used to raise, and this is the colonial argument they're using as well. I would argue, sir, they won, the Zionists defeated the Arab armies in battles. They haven't won the war because the expulsion of the people is still ongoing. So in one way, you could argue the resistance and the fight is still going on. It's not actually ended. But again, it's, you know, there's various arguments for information warfare, you know, in any war. This is just another one of those.
And last question, Adnan. The Jews, they deserve a homeland, especially because of the suffering with the Holocaust.
So Yusuf, with this, I actually agree with this. Not just Jews. I think all people should have a land where they can live. You want to call that a homeland, fine. You should be able to live in peace. You should be able to live with people. You should be able to get on with your life. if you have different beliefs, you should be able to practice your beliefs. The Jews, I believe, should have that as well. I believe all people should have it. The Jews, yes, they did suffer in the Holocaust. So they probably won their own land where they can live in safety even more. I completely agree with that. And I think what I've just said, nobody will disagree. Why can't Palestinians and Jews live side by side in Palestine? That would be the solution to this problem. There were Jews in Palestine, although they were small in number. Problem you've got here, Yusuf, this is not what's going on. Because the Jews were persecuted and because they had the Holocaust, this argument is saying it's okay for them to seize and steal somebody else's land and reside there. And that's the problem. The Tamils in India are much larger in number than Zionists. They don't have a homeland. There are many, the Kurds don't have a homeland. They don't have their own nation. There are many people in the world, many ethnicities, who live or are integrated into other countries. They don't have their homeland. If people want their own land, they should have their own land, of course. Does that now make it okay for you to seize somebody else's land? Of course not. And I think that's the problem with this argument, what he's doing. And many Jews say this, and Noam Chomsky has said this, that because of Jewish history, what they're saying is okay for them to go to a land, steal the territory, and expel the people. That's okay because of what happened to them. Yeah, and you know, I'm sure everyone will say that's wrong. You can't agree to that. So yes, the Jews, all people deserve their own homeland. No one's arguing they shouldn't. Should you now take over somebody else's homeland? That's a problem. So really what should have actually happened, Yusuf, is Jews in Europe who wanted to return to Palestine should have gone to Palestine, should have raised the money, and should have bought land or bought their home and lived side by side with Muslims. Because for a millennia, from 600, Yusuf, until 1917 when the British did their military occupation, minus the 1100s, Muslim, Jews and Christians live side by side in Palestine. When the Zionists have come, they are not saying Jews, Muslims, Christians live side by side. What they're saying is they are going to rule over the land. They're going to take over the territory. They're going to expel the people. The people who remain are going to live on an apartheid system. So you're seeing this language already, Yusuf. You're seeing this language of we want to expel the people of Gaza. We want them to leave. That's the problem with this argument.
One last question, Adnan. Where do you see this current situation heading?
So Yusuf, up until a couple of days ago, my view was Netanyahu has to go to war. He's been completely undermined. The Israeli invincibility narrative has been hit, so they have to go to war. And what will happen is they will launch an onslaught. And at some point, they will claim victory to say, we've taught them a lesson and we've put the Palestinian resistance, we've set it back decades. We are now 7 days after 7th of October. And Israel still hasn't launched an attack. And actually, what I'm seeing, Yusuf, is more and more divisions. So one of the things that Israeli leadership has been busy with, they've been electing a new government. It's a coalition government they actually have. And there seems to be differences with Netanyahu. In fact, it seems that all the other leaders in the coalition, they're seeing that Netanyahu's position is really weak. Do you really want to be seen with Netanyahu? And secondly, they're looking at the opportunity to completely get rid of him. So the fact that Israel hasn't gone in yet, I think that shows that there's actually division. The other problem, Yusuf, is when 9/11 happened, and I use this example because we're seeing 9/11 terminology being used. America's solution to 9/11 was the war on terror. And the war on terror caused more terrorism in the world. It led to the emergence of ISIS, and then it led to 2 decades occupation and humiliation for America. Today, America is in a weaker position and a humiliated position compared because of its solution to 9/11. If Israel goes down the same route, at the moment, a lot of Israelis, or officially Israelis, want blood. In 5 years' time, if things get worse, which is very likely because that's what 9/11 did, what you might find is their views will be very different. I would say, Yusuf, if in 5 to 10 days' time, once they invade, there's no clear victory, they're going to have a massive problem. People will turn against Netanyahu. So, up to a few days ago, I was quite clear what I think will happen. But what's actually been revealed in just the last couple of days is why hasn't Netanyahu gone in? Israel has always been launching strikes in the West Bank and Gaza. They've always been doing it. They've already got the 300,000 troops ready. Why haven't they gone in? They've got international public opinion on their side because there's implication that this doesn't work. Netanyahu has gone from 8 days ago being one of the most, you know, he'd be remembered in Israeli history for normalizing relationship with the Sunni leadership, Saudi Arabia. To today, normalization is down in the dumps. And now he's worried on the outcome of the war. And the reason why the outcome of the war is questionable, Yusuf, is
Israeli forces are going to be fighting urban warfare. And as we saw in Afghanistan, the indigenous people have the advantage because they take advantage of the terrain. In urban warfare, the advantage is to the defender. So the Israelis can attack from the air. There's 150 Israeli hostages that the resistance in Palestine has in the Gaza Strip. So if you put all of that together, Yusuf, it's a much more complicated picture. Up to a few days ago, the picture was very black and white. The Israelis have to go in. Now, what I sense is they are considering, Netanyahu is even considering, if things don't go fine, if next week, Yusuf, Israel hasn't achieved overwhelming victory, you've been attacked by Palestinian resistance groups one weekend. 2 weeks later, you still haven't conquered or flattened Gaza. They're going to have a massive problem on their hand. So in answer to your question, Yusuf, I think there will be an invasion. I think the invasion is going to be very complicated and there's going to be a lot of unintended consequences.
Thank you for your time today, Adam. I'm sure there's going to be many more updates, articles, deep dives on our website about this issue. You can all learn more about this issue by accessing our website. I'm Yusuf. Thank you for listening.